Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks so much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Glad to have you back again. I don't have to tell you that we live in very politically polarized times. The opposite poles of this political spectrum have arguably never been so far apart or with so unbridgeable a chasm between them. Our national discourse is so boiling over with poisonous rancor, mean-spirited stereotyping, and vicious character assassination that the likelihood of us cooling down the rhetoric to some degree, a degree that we can actually talk with each other instead of screaming at each other, seems impossible. Seriously, in this political atmosphere, where do we as Americans begin to come together again? And I don't mean come together to the extent that we are all of one mind, united in agreement about every issue, because that's obviously never going to happen, even under the best of circumstances. And that's okay, we can disagree. But I mean just united as a country, united to the extent that we don't, that half the country doesn't see the other half as a hated enemy who literally needs to be eradicated. Now, yes, a good deal of all of this political polarization and ill will are driven by the cesspool of social media, which by its very nature fosters personal attacks and disunity rather than community, and by a manipulative news media that has a vested interest in keeping this conflict simmering, if not actually bubbling over. A nation cannot sustain itself this way. There has to be enough of a sense of mutual understanding and respect and civility and willingness to at least engage in productive conversation for a society to function with some degree of normality. An entire country can't always be at each other's throats in this kind of raging conflagration. I think one of the first steps toward averting societal breakdown is learning how to have what currently seems to be impossible conversations. And purely by coincidence, I happen to be holding in my hands a book that's about 5 years old now. You may be familiar with it, in fact. It's called How to Have Impossible Conversations, a very practical guide. It's a book about how to communicate effectively with people who hold radically different beliefs from yours. So in these times, that's obviously a very relevant book. And again, purely by coincidence, my guest today at the Right Take happens to be one of the two co-authors of that book. He is a very interesting guy who's all over the internet talking with high-powered people who are engaged in the culture war, expounding on topics like wokeness and cancel culture and the fraud of academia. I'm happy and excited to have him on the show. I think you're going to find him a fascinating guy. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so that you can keep up with all the conversations we are having here with important thinkers and writers and pundits, scholars and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is, I think, a uniquely interesting thinker, philosopher, and educator. His writing has appeared in mainstream publications like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the American Mind and many, many scholarly publications. He's taught everywhere from universities to think tanks, from Fortune 500 companies to prisons. He's currently a founding faculty fellow at the University of Austin and the director of the National Progress Alliance. Peter Boghossian, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate having me on.
I'm very glad to have you on. First of all, tell us what goes on at the National Progress Alliance. What's that all about and what's your mission there?
That's a great question. I love questions about my actual work.
Yeah.
So thank you. We fight for freedom of speech. We fight back against ideological capture of institutions. Like right now, it's the academy, but it's not merely limited to the academy. We try to do work that's demonstrable, that moves the needle about various problems in which we face, and we tie that back into the academic literature where it sprung from. So we're a small nonprofit. We just have a team of three full-time people, and we basically work from the moment we wake up to the moment I go to sleep. I have 1 hour a day where I take a break and I do jiu-jitsu, and that's it, literally all.
How can people check National Progress Alliance out and support it?
Oh, I appreciate that. We have a YouTube channel. We're on all social media, just nationalprogressalliance.org.
You've got, I think, a really wide-ranging intellectual background. What do you see as the thread or focus that ties it all together? Is there sort of a particular focus that is kind of the mission of your work in general?
Breaking through ideologies, beliefs, interventions to help people live better lives that enable them to flourish, critical thinking and moral reasoning. That's where I did my dissertation, to help prison inmates desist from violent behavior, particularly violent behavior, as opposed to just desist from criminal activities. In other words, hurting people. We get trapped in ways of thinking and ways of believing that are harmful. And then we manifest those in our relationships and our friendships with other people. And so part of that, and within that suite of things in which I'm interested, is teaching people how to have better conversations to converse across deep ideological divides.
Well, not to pigeonhole you, but how would you describe yourself politically? Or do you even see that as a relevant question in your work as a philosopher? Do you approach issues and arguments through a political lens at all?
Not well. I guess if I had to say, I'm more of a classical liberal broadly. But I think Christopher Hitchens said, "You tell me any two positions somebody has, and if I can tell you a third, they're rather boring." To paraphrase, I do the best that I can to formulate my beliefs on the basis of evidence, the best available evidence. So whether it's the trans thing and trans in kids, you know, you have the CAS report or the WPATH report that shows that there was no data. And even specious data, falsified data that pulled people's moral strings like marionettes. So I don't think that the right left is a useful axis anymore. And I think that a better way to think about it is those who want cognitive liberty and those who do not, and those who want freedoms, basic freedoms, and those who do not. And the people, regardless of one's metaphysical beliefs, whether one is a Christian or a Muslim or what have you, that's tired. I call that Cultural War 1.0. Cultural War 2.0 is much more sophisticated and asymmetrical, where people who would normally not be allies, like atheists and Christians, ally against other people who are atheists and Christians who subscribe to a certain set of beliefs about how people should live their lives and what they must believe. And that's very unchristian, by the way. And I'm not a Christian, but that's very unchristian.
You mentioned culture war. The whole thrust of this podcast and my own writing is the intersection of politics and culture. And I'm probably guilty of using the term culture war far more often than I should. I think a lot of people find it maybe an unsophisticated or an overused way to refer to the cultural conflicts that we in the West are currently engaged in. Is culture war a term that you find useful and accurate, or is there another way we should be framing it or thinking about it?
I think it's great. What's the problem with it? It is a culture war. It is a war of cultures. You know, Huntington said it's a clash of civilizations. You could look at it that way if you're looking at Islamic immigration in Europe, or the recent vote with Le Pen in France, or the Brexit. You could look at it. That could be a lens. It's just a lens. It's just a linguistic placeholder or terminology that you use to classify a larger cultural and political phenomenon. So that seems perfectly fine to me.
It does to me too, but I know some people may think of it as kind of overused, or it doesn't really, it's not quite accurate enough, but that's good to hear. And I sometimes think of the culture war as more as a civilizational war. But
Well, yeah, that could be said too. I'd ask them if they don't like culture war, what they'd prefer to use. The problem with civilizational wars is you have these internecine fights or these internecine battles that civilizational war doesn't quite capture it because it's from the same civilization.
Let me back up a little bit into your past. I know you've been over this topic many times, so I won't ask you to summarize it. But just as a reminder to my listeners, I want to bring up the incident, the affair you were involved in called... it's sometimes called the Grievance Studies Affair or the Grievance Studies Hoax, in which you and a couple of your academic colleagues really skewered some of the most pompous bullshitters among your fellow academics and not just skewered them, but impaled them. I mean, it was pretty brutal, in which you and your two colleagues, James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose, got managed to get a number of mock academic articles published that were hilariously parodic or satirical, but treated seriously by the academic community. All three of you must have known going into that hoax, if you want to call it that, that it would make you all renegades to some extent in the academic community, that it would might ostracize you from the in-group. Were you all okay with embracing that outsider status, and have you felt canceled to any extent in the academic community?
Well, there's no possible way I could ever get an academic job, but fortunately for myself, I don't want one. The whole system is utterly corrupt. It's irredeemable, and I believe it should be burned to the ground. So, yeah, you're not alone in thinking that, and I'm certainly not alone. I mean, look, it's better to learn nothing than to learn false things. And we're teaching people ways of thinking and ways of viewing the world that are not only false, that are harmful, divisive. You know, you talked about culture war. You're teaching people to hate their own society, to hate their own culture. Look, if you don't want a monument in your city, then by all means, go through the democratic process and have the monument removed. I mean, that's what democracy is. You have no right to thuggery. You have no right to bully, to beat people who want the monument there and to rip it down yourselves. So these are some of the behaviors that we're teaching people. And if you don't believe me, just look at look at what just happened at Portland State University, where I used to teach. Antifa and thugs basically... Well, not basically. They did take over the library. The president of the university, and I do not know the president, did not want the police to go in. They caused $825,000 worth of damage. There's no accountability. That goes right onto the taxpayer. That should come out of the salaries of the administrators. So there is a and what did they do it for? They did it ostensibly. They did it for Gaza. How does destroying books and spray painting walls have anything to do with Gaza? It doesn't. So we have a confluence of factors, among which is a crisis of cowardice, and this idea that there is no meritocracy. There's, in terms of who rises to the hierarchy in academia, this is an answer to your question. It's not because you publish the most or you have what's called an H index. You just go to, you can plug mine in, just go to scholar.google.com. It's not because of any of those metrics. It's because of ideological conformity and one's pushing a certain narrative and holding one's belief. And of course, even greater than that is exogenous physical characteristics like being black or claiming to be born in the wrong body or what have you. So this is no, these are no institutions of which I want a part. They have no integrity and they damage student learning and the society as a whole. And these are, one more thing, just make no mistake about it. These are people with astonishingly mediocre minds.
Along those lines, back, I think in 2021, I believe it was, you took a principled stand against that ideology that you saw engulfing Portland State and you, where you were teaching, and you very publicly resigned. Can you tell us a little bit about that, about your resignation letter and what point you were trying to get across?
Sure. I jumped into the abyss. I didn't know what was waiting for me. I had a job for life. I had what's called continuous employment. I quit in a letter that shocked me. It went viral. I was just shocking. It was translated to so many languages across the world. I was kidding. There's literally just tens of thousands of emails. I mean, it was truly, truly crazy. But basically, the university, the longer I stayed there, the more it compromised my integrity, the more it damaged student learning. Students were thinking they were learning something and they weren't learning something. It was an overtly hostile idea to critical thought, reason, rationality. People don't really understand how those who traffic in the ideology use the word critical, like critical studies or critical something. But this is they hired me to teach critical thinking, and then they made that absolutely impossible.
Before I forget, I want to make sure that my listeners are aware of an important book that you co-wrote about 5 or so years ago with James Lindsay, who is an important thinker in his own right, a book called How to Have Impossible Conversations, a very practical guide. Everybody from Richard Dawkins to Glenn Beck recommends this book, and I do too. It's about how to communicate effectively with people who have radically different beliefs from yours. And these days, man, that makes this book a must read, doesn't it?
Thanks. I appreciate that. Dan Dennett, the former philosopher, my friend, used to say whenever you try to do something, my advice, if you are in academia, young academics or people who want to write a book, think about making a work of, quote, abiding significance, unquote. That is, someone can look at it, subspecies eternitatis, under the watchful eye of eternity, and look back and say, wow, that wasn't linked to a time or place or situation, but that offered timeless advice. So it's my life work. I built on the stuff I did in the prisons. I built on the stuff I did in the atheist movement. And now I go all around the world and we have conversations with people and we teach them how to speak across divides. And those are non-scripted, by the way. I don't know anybody. We find random people on the street.
Would you say social media has exacerbated that division or created more opportunities for dialogue? Or both?
It's very funny. No, I don't think it's created more opportunities for dialogue.
I don't think so. I was trying to be generous. Generous to social media.
That's very generous. No, that's good. No, I think it's a cesspool. And as my writing partner says, it's not only a cesspool, it's a cesspool that follows you. So I think it's been terrible. Jonathan Haidt, the sociologist from NYU, has some really good stuff on that. It's social media is dividing us. People are doing things for likes, and it's almost impossible to have a genuine conversation across the platforms, particularly X, or what was formerly known as Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think of social media as a net negative. I mean, there are some, you know, good, it offers some good potential and opportunities, but overall it's detrimental to us mentally and intellectually and emotionally and every other way.
Yeah. We all thought it would have an auriferous effect on us as a society. Just kind of like we'd all just sprout wings and go into this intellectual or idea space. We would challenge each other, et cetera, but it turned out to be something quite different.
Yeah. You mentioned critical theory a moment ago. I think a lot of people have gradually become aware of critical theory as the sort of the intellectual basis for all of these things like wokeness and anti-racism that have come to really dominate conversations. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the actual aim of critical theory not to add to the body of wisdom of our humanity that we've accumulated over the millennia, but literally to break it down, to dismantle the progress that we've made so far until the whole structure has collapsed? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a perpetual and perennial critique that exposes relationships of subordination and domination, and oppression is oppression everywhere. And the idea is to remediate that and ameliorate the pain and import a kind of equity model, although that's been something that's recently been hammered into critical theory, import a kind of equity model in which the inequities of the past are made up for. It's Ibram X. Kendi's famous line about fixing racism in the past by being racism. Now the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. Yeah. Again, it's just a mountain of stupid. There's no there. All of the stuff is just idiotic. So you could spend all your time thinking about this stuff. It's a complete waste of time.
Why is critical theory, which seems so anti-intellectual, actually, and even anti-human, why is it so perversely attractive to presumably educated people like academics? Emphasis on the word presumably.
Yeah, they're not educated. If you look at Book 7 of Plato's Republic, he talks about leaving the cave. You know, this idea that your listeners are probably familiar with that. So it's not about education. It's not about, it's redefining the purpose of education. And the purpose of education is to liberate people from oppression. That's Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator's shtick. And that is what's taught in colleges of education. That's what's taught to teachers. So it's no longer about grammar or writing or academic excellence. I just went to my daughter's graduation, and the principal, I think it was last month, could have been the month before, was it July? Yeah, it was in June. And the principal gave a 25-minute lecture. The whole thing was about race and sexual orientation and sexual status and feeling safe. She didn't say one single thing about academic excellence, working hard, studying. So it is really like a mind virus that's taken over people. It's taken over the whole society, or at least many people have found themselves in the orbit of the ideology. Even conservatives are skeptical of making certain criticisms. But it's particularly trenchant in academia.
Do you think that ideology, the whole critical theory ideology, do you think that's beginning to collapse under the weight of its own inability to offer any kind of a positive vision?
Yeah, I don't think that's why it's collapsing. I don't think positive vision is even relevant. In fact, I admit to being Pollyanna about this. I lost a $1,000 bet to Chris Rufo about when wokeism would be extirpated from the soil of society. And so I have to go down, and he wants me to pay this guy $1,000. So I'm going to fly down and give this guy $1,000 for my lost bet. But no, I mean, it is inherently unsustainable. And there are only a few ways you can sustain an idea that's unsustainable. So it has no 1 Peter 3:15. It has no principle of an apologia. It has no inherent defense because it doesn't value dialogue and discourse. So you have to enforce it some other way, political correctness or blasphemy laws, or it has to be, Biden's, I try not to make this political, but, in certain contexts, it is Biden's putting in equity rules that govern entire branches of the United States government. So there has to be some other way, like lawfare or but there is no, it's just a mountain of stupid. There's really nothing even remotely interesting about it. And that's the thing. If it were a little less stupid, people would have woken up sooner and said, holy shit, like this is just crazy. But it's just so crazy. It's so fucking crazy that people don't believe that anyone actually believes this. That's the problem with it.
Before we started recording, you and I were talking about potential topics, and I mentioned that I wanted to address a lot of the work that you've done since that whole Grievous Studies affair about enlightening people about how to combat the ideology of wokeness. And you said something really interesting to me. I have not heard anyone say, and I think it would be really useful. I'd love to love for you to share your take on the significance of wokeness at this moment.
My take on the significance. Well, there is wholesale ideological capture of institutions. I used to think way back in like 2012, people couldn't actually believe this, or they would believe something. They would adopt the propositions of the ideology only in terms of matters of no significance or matters of no consequence. Like, they don't give a shit about philosophy, so yes, okay, we're going to have diversity hirings in philosophy. But now it's in medicine. It's at, for example, in UCLA, diversity hiring of doctors. It's in American Airlines, diversity hiring of pilots. And let's be crystal clear about something. The moment that you introduce any other characteristic than merit, by definition, you have to take your eye off the telos of the discharging the mission. Like, I mean, just think about it in terms of sports. The moment you say, well, we need so many gay players on the team, or so many players who think they're trapped in the wrong body, or anything. I mean, so many midgets on the basketball team. The moment that you do that, you've made winning less important. By definition, you have to have different outcomes. I mean, how could you have the same outcomes when you're not looking at merit? So this is what we've done to ourselves. And the only consequence of this is that planes will fall out of the sky. It's inevitable. And even if they fall out of the sky for reasons of no one's fault, if there are black pilots, they'll blame it on the black pilots. They say, look, you're black. You're not capable of doing this. Glenn Lowry in his recent book talks about that. The black academic, John McWhorter, has talked about that. It's incredibly demeaning to qualified, competent black people. I mean, that's just a hint of the answer there. So it's ideological capture is one thing. How do we get this out of our institutions? How do we, I mean, this is a very, very, very complicated problem.
You mentioned to me also before we began recording that you felt that wokeness was dead, actually. And I'm happy to hear that. What can you elaborate on that a little bit?
I think wokeness is certainly, like, you can criticize things. You can certainly, wokeness is not what it was even a few years ago. It's fallen largely into ill repute. I thought it would fall into ill repute more expeditiously, but I was incorrect in that assessment. But there's no question that it's, I mean, when I first started the National Progress Alliance, everyone had nicknames because they were terrified of using their real names. People, a lot of this stuff has been exposed for what it is. But the anti-woke space isn't doing itself any favors. It's become a large echo chamber. It's filled with Christian nationalists. It has people who are legitimately grifting. You know, you hear that term a lot. It's very easy to be, you know, to fight against this stuff now, but where were these people 10 years ago? And you know, it's also characterized largely, though certainly not exclusively, a lot of people have these pompous, self-assured attitudes, but they haven't done the work. Not that even if they had done the work would justify that, but they haven't done the work. I doubt they've even read a single paper from the Journal of Fat Studies, or I doubt they've even read a single paper, but yet they go in with a kind of self-assured confidence, and they don't even know the other side of the issue. And that's exactly the problem with woke people. So that's a problem that we see. That's just the human condition. So you don't want to be a part of that. You want to fight back against it, right? And but in order to do that, you need certain tools and techniques that has to really do have to infiltrate movements, certain values to change the moral mind.
Let me shift gears. I'd love to get your take on the state of masculinity today. That's a topic that has become larger in the public mind than it was even just a couple of years ago. But I'd love to get your take on what's happening to the state of masculinity and maybe where it needs to go.
Boy, that's a great, great question. We could talk a long time about that. I just... doing a chart with a psychologist in which we talk about, well, let me reverse it and back up. The state of masculinity, the state of males, particularly white males, is not good. They're not doing well. They're told they're bad. They're told they're racist. They're told they're oppressors. You have the rise of the incel and the volcel, the voluntary celibate. You have, you know, this culture in which we currently live in which it's acceptable to dump on heterosexuality. It's acceptable to dump on, or even worse than dump on, castigate people who, through no fault of their own, are born in certain bodies, white bodies, tall bodies, blue-eyed bodies, heterosexual bodies. And even the framing of that, that's how they frame it, bodies, you know, people born in fat bodies. And so being in that culture and experiencing that is horrific for our young men. It's horrific for dating people. Young men are having sex, much less more young people than they would. The complaints within relationships, if you look at relationship satisfaction, they're down. You also see a few phenomena that nobody talks about that I'd like to bring up. One is that marriage is becoming a province found only among upper middle class and upper class people. And people in different social classes aren't, not only are they not marrying, but they're cohabitating and having kids and then splitting up. To me, this is not a moral judgment. I do not think that this is a moral matter. I'm willing to have that conversation, but at least the primary concern is secondary, tertiary, ancillary concerns. You could make the claim that it's moral, but one of the consequences, this is ripe in the Black community. One of the things that you see as a consequence of this, if you look at the criminogenic factors, which are responsible for, you know, there are three factors. Matt Thornton also writes about this in the book, The Gift of Violence. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. I wrote the afterword to that book. And Rob Wolf, the New York Times bestselling author, wrote the foreword. So you can predict who's going to be involved in crime, particularly violent crime, by three factors. One is the age. So it's common 16 to 26. I believe that's what it is. Don't quote me on that. Something like that. The second is these two people can guess. It's, you know, young men are far more involved in violent crimes than young women. And the third is the presence of an adult male in the home. And that's something very few people talk about. They want to pin it on race or what's called race realism. But if you look in the Black community, and I can tell you the response of race realists to this, but if you look in the Black community, there's a crisis of a lack of adult males in the home. I think this last weekend in Chicago, there were 100 shootings, all of which were among African Americans. So these are our citizens killing the other citizens in our communities. And the mayor of Chicago blames it on Richard Nixon. So
I saw that.
Yeah, I mean, you just can't make it up. I mean, it's just so stupid. It's just a profound lack of honesty. But anyway, I think that you can't really talk about that problem honestly unless you talk about the lack of an adult male in the home.
We're in a time where masculinity is basically demonized as toxic in its very nature, but no one ever talks about toxic femininity.
Right. I do think, look, to steelman this stuff, I do think that there are, to steelman means to make an argument for the position. I do think that there is a kind of toxic masculinity that the semantic range of the term has broadened so that people use it to mean basically stuff guys do, like, you know, whatever it is. But I do think that there is a kind of toxic masculinity that, oddly enough, is found in, I have to be very careful about what I say. When I say, I want to balance the line because I know some people have a heart attack and I don't, those are the people I'm trying to convince this. Those elements of toxic masculinity, let's put it this way, are found less frequently in the United States than they are in other cultures. And anyone who is not willing to be honest about that, you are not a sincere person. You are simply insincere. Or you're just mistaken. Like, you're just delusional about the state of reality. You know, there are two surahs in the Quran. What is the inheritance of a man versus a woman? How many court testimonies does a woman's voice count for? I mean, so one could say that, you know, that's more of a patriarchy than a toxic masculinity. But I do think that people are not being honest about the nature of the problem. But again, to give it to steelman it, that there are toxic ways that men relate to women and men relate to themselves. And then those need to be addressed, you know, speaking over women or telling women to smile or, not treating women in a way that's, people can even make the claim that chivalry is a toxically masculine. I don't believe that at all, but I do believe that there are ingrained ways that men engage with women that are unhelpful and unhealthy.
We talked about the cesspool nature of social media. On the social media, I would say there are a growing number of what I would call masculinity gurus out there, ranging from say Jordan Peterson on one hand, all the way to Andrew Tate, maybe at the opposite end of the spectrum. I would guess that you think there's probably a lot of grifting going on in that field too.
I don't think Peterson's a grifter. I think Peterson offers fantastic advice for young men. I think there's a reason Peterson is very popular for young men. What I would love to see, I think there are a lot of spaces between Peterson and Tate. I think Tate is a scum. I think he is a misogynist. I think he gives horrific advice. I think young men look up to him. I will say that he's quite a good kickboxer, and I respect that about him. But I think that he is leading young men toward very dangerous and self-destructive and very ugly ways of treating women. And I think it's a shame. He should have no platform whatsoever in terms of any advice he has to give to young men.
Yeah, I totally agree with you about Tate and Peterson in that respect. And it's funny that you mentioned the word chivalry, because I've actually been working on a book about that for a while. Oh, wow. So I'd love to, you know, get more of a take on that from you. I know you're a super busy guy, and I don't want to keep you too long. Maybe we'll have another conversation one of these days about masculinity. But let me ask you, do you have a new book in the works that we could look forward to?
I do. I have a bunch of them. I have one that I wrote that I haven't had a chance to get back to. So, you know, feeding the YouTube algorithm is quite a task. And we go all around the world and we do videos. So videos have been my primary concern. But I do. I have a children's book or a young adult book about that I'm going to work on. It's about a young Socrates who travels the land and foments a rebellion against the gods while making friends with people who have deep-seated belief differences. And then I'm working on another book right now. It's about it's basically for young men, and it deals with things about friendships, relationships, diet, exercise, how to succeed, why you should succeed, etc. So that's my current undertaking.
What's the best place online for people to go to keep up with you from day to day? Should they just go to peterbogosian.com or?
I never use Instagram, but we're on Instagram. Someone posts my Instagram stuff. I'm on Twitter or X, where I just kind of post things I'm thinking about. And then we're on YouTube. We post a lot of videos, again, around the world conversations. I just had one I really liked about. It went from the ethics of eating meat to how much a person's life is worth. And I travel with this guy, Reed. We go everywhere together. Everyone thinks we're gay. We go everywhere together. And, I asked her, what's Reed's life worth? You know, is Reed's life worth two giraffes? Is Reed's worth life worth, you know, five anthills? But so basically we figured out what Reed's life is worth. It's not very much, by the way. So if you want like a three-legged goat, I think he's in there too. But, you can find me on YouTube as well. And I'm all over the place. I'm doing interviews and podcasts. And I have a podcast too. I actually forgot about that. Oh, yeah. I'm pretty busy.
Where do people go for the podcast?
Oh, they could just, I think it's like Peter Boghossian. Yeah, no, it's on across all platforms, at Flitza. It's actually, I just got the statistics the other day. I was like, holy shit, wow, that's really like a lot of people are tuning into that. So it's good. I basically invite people on the show to talk about things that I want to think about. So I've been thinking a lot about DMT lately, which is fascinating. If you don't know what that is, you should seriously look into it. And I've been thinking about, so basically whatever I happen to be thinking about, I invite people on, I have conversations with them about it. So it's a pretty cool life. It's pretty good.
Good to know. Peter Boghossian, thanks so much for coming on The Right Take.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, find Peter online on YouTube and elsewhere. Check out what he's up to and make sure you get a copy of How to Have Impossible Conversations. It's a must read. And thanks, as always, for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having there. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.